Wang. Okay. Raj. Did I see Raj? Yeah. Leah. Jen's here. Let's see if I've missed anybody here. Annika, Cristiano,
Hi, Amir.
Claire, Jeff,
I'm here.
Scott,
I'm here.
Ken, or Miguel, Leah, James.
Yep, I'm here.
Okay, that should do it. Well, I know that CFAS meetings have been taking up an inordinate amount of time.
Amen.
And practice sessions, and the SAB is putting in numerous hours each week, going over practice sessions, each lasting an hour. And so I would like to keep today as short as possible. I mean, we have a practice session after this for one of the new projects. So I thought about just canceling it, but I felt we didn't have one last month. So we should at least get together. And then there might be some administrative questions as CFAS 4 comes to an end, and how that happens. There's Miguel. And is Ken there?
Yes.
Okay. The only one I'm missing is Claire now. And Annika. All right. Well, so we have Joe Wang on and Elizabeth Powell on. So perhaps they can answer some of those questions at the end of this Zoom call that we might have about the transition projects from four to either not moving forward or the possibility of CFAS 5 getting funded and what that would mean in terms of budgetary constraints and carryovers or offsets or whatever. But our main item today is Johan kindly agreed to present some data on his zebrafish and genetic study. So unless there are any questions or comments, I think we can just turn it over to Johan and move forward. Any questions? All right, Johan, it's all yours.
Great, thank you, Ed. Let's see if I can share my screen appropriately. So I just wanted to go over some data that we've been working on. Actually, I just submitted this as an R01, but any feedback you all have would be greatly, greatly appreciated. It's kind of an extension off what we've been doing on the face, but now looking at the brain based on some recent findings that we've had in the lab. And so I thought I'd just start off showing you sort of the model that we're going for. I'm not going to delve into great detail on any of the aims that I propose. Any sort of scientific ideas that you all have, I would appreciate hearing them. The model is the central bit of the model is not surprising. You've heard of some of these things from Scott and myself already. So NNT, being a gene that's critical in the mitochondria and buffering against oxidative stress. And so basically our model is based on our findings, well, a lot of people's findings and some recent, relatively recent work that says that not all neural subtypes have the same basal level of reactive oxygen, which would then predispose them to oxidative stress. And so our general model is that you have neuronal precursors, our stem cells that we can identify with markers such as SOX2, and that then they develop into a mature neuron, which would be labeled by a generalized marker like a transcription factor ELAP-like 3. And then this population would then differentiate into the variety of neuronal cell types that we have. And we think it's at this step, this from becoming a mature neuron and then going on to differentiate, where these neurons are sensitized to oxidative stress. So every cell has a basal level of reactive oxygen. And when that level gets too high, the cells can experience oxidative stress. And so NNT, you've heard this from Scott before, so I won't belabor it, but so that's buffering against reactive oxygen. And then during events of oxidative stress, there's a whole set of genes that would be activated. In zebrafish, this god-awfully named gene right here is one of those that's very well characterized to be activated in the event of oxidative stress. So the model is generally that ethanol is generating reactive oxygen that then in sensitized neuronal populations, that's going to generate oxidative stress. There's some evidence that oxidative stress can impinge negatively on the mTOR pathway, which you've heard me talk a ton about. And so I'm not going to talk about any of the individual members, but just the activity of this pathway. And so this inhibition then we think can lead to one of two things. So apoptosis, fairly well characterized that ethanol does this, but we also think that based on these recent findings that different neuronal populations require different levels of reactive oxygen for their differentiation, that there may be an effect on here. So the data that lead us to this model, and we think, obviously, we love thinking about the modulation of this event, so there, that there, in addition to these core members, there must be additional genetic modulation to this pathway. So the basic evidence of this notion that this is happening at the level as neurons mature, we have a lot of data for the MIS. So Desiree Buckley published the first work from the lab with ELAB-like 3, demonstrating it was differentially that you lost a population of these neurons. We have RNA-seq data that shows that there's a reduction in ELAB-like 3. That RNA-seq data also showed that there was no alteration to SOX2. So the neuronal progenitors appear to be present at normal levels where we have a reduction in mature neurons. And so this, I'm showing you this single piece of data because I'm very proud of it. I made it myself. This is single molecule fluorescent in situ hybridization. So it's really zoomed out. It's hard to see, but each individual dot is an individual mRNA for encoding one of these two genes. And so in this, basically we're looking down at the brain. So this is the midbrain and the hindbrain. And generally you see that SOX2 looks pretty normal. Whereas ELAB-like 3, if we separate these channels, you see kind of gaps where you should be seeing these mature neurons present, but they're not. So there appears to be a loss of mature neurons due to ethanol. And I should point out that these first few slides, these are just straight up wild type fish. So we're using this 1% dose of alcohol that doesn't do much to the face. That'll be important again later. But it does have an impact on the brain, not surprisingly. If we take a look at any individual neuronal subpopulations, so even though there's a general reduction in this pan neuronal marker, there does not appear to be a generalized reduction in every specific cell type. So again, I'm showing you the single molecule fluorescent in situ hybridizations, but our RNA-seq data also support this. So basically we have a marker for dopaminergic neurons here in red. These are GABAergic neurons and serotonergic neurons here. And so of these three populations that I'm showing you, the dopaminergic neurons appear most sensitized. So each of these are individual cells expressing this dopamine transporter, and you see a reduction in that. And, you know, A former postdoc in my lab has shown that this dose of ethanol sensitizes these fish to behavioral deficits that are associated with the dopaminergic system. So again, this isn't terribly surprising, but it's saying that there's that different neuronal subpopulations react to the same dose of alcohol differently. And so I told you that we had this RNA-seq data set, and you've heard about this technique from Scott, so I'm not going to go into the detail, but we're just getting a transcriptomic idea of what happens in when an embryo is exposed to ethanol. And so one of the things that we did to use that is to use a chemical prediction database called LINX. Basically, you have a set of differentially expressed genes from your data set, your RNA-seq data, and they have a bunch of cell lines that have been exposed to a bunch of different chemicals. And then this, this website will compare your differentially expressed genes to differentially expressed genes from these chemical exposures. And ones that match, you would expect to have an interaction to sort of exacerbate the phenotype in this. The opposite is true, even though I'm not showing here. So if you have an opposite signature, they should ameliorate one another. And so from that RNA-seq data set, the most highly enriched GO term, so a biological term, is neural development. And so we took those differentially expressed genes, put them into the LINX data set, and these are the top 10 chemicals predicted to have a similar transcriptomic effect. And so in yellow, showing you that of these top 10, four of those are all inhibiting this PI3K mTOR pathway at some level that I've told you about in facial development. Interestingly, another one of them is actually a producer of reactive oxygen. So supporting this notion so that bioinformatically we predict that there's an interaction with reactive oxygen and the mTOR pathway in the genesis of these neural defects. And so then what we want to do, one of the main points of the grant is that we can take advantage of sort of the small size and the genetics in zebrafish to really move through this with a high throughput. And so this is sort of some of the data that I'm going to show you. What we do is take these little zebrafish embryos, array them in a 96-well plate, where one embryo will be in each of these wells. And then you can have different treatments that I'm just showing here in colors. But then we can read out, say, the level of mature neurons through this transgenic that we have. And you can also do other things, lots of different things. You could look at apoptosis. This is a marker of reactive oxygen species. And then we can just put that into a plate reader and quantify the levels of neurons, reactive oxygen, apoptosis, anything that we want. And so to start out with, we just wanted to see if rapamycin, which is an inhibitor of the mTOR pathway, and ethanol had similar effects. And so there are two sets of graphs here. These two, and each of them is sort of no treatment, is not sort of, it is in fact no treatment. And then in here on the left, we have sort of these higher doses that we've been using, 1% ethanol, 1% or 1 micromolar rapamycin, which have pretty strong effects on the embryo. They both reduce the number of ELAB-like positive cells, presumably based on the fluorescence. Here we're using lower doses. So now here at 0.25% ethanol, and just so everyone's on board, that's in the media. So 0.25% ethanol, if we extrapolate this to a human blood alcohol, that would be a dose that you could drive home legally with. And so that or inhibition at 1/4 of this level of rapamycin, there's a trend there, but it's not significant. So they look like an untreated embryo, but you combine those two, and now you have this significant reduction in the level of mature neurons, supporting this notion that there's an interaction between the mTOR pathway and ethanol in the survival or genesis of these mature neurons. And so then what we wanted to do then is to take a look at these genes that are involved in modulating reactive oxygen and the response to that. So we've been working with Scott for a long time with NNT. We made these, and I've shown you some of their phenotypes. I'm not gonna do that again, but just to show you, so now we're looking specifically at neurons. So if we take a look at neuronal cell death, if you take away NNT, there's a little increase. You expose wild types to ethanol, there's a little increase, but you combine those two, the genetic loss of NNT and the exposure, you have this dramatic increase in the level of apoptosis. This here is basically quantifying the overall fluorescence of a marker, the cell rocks for reactive oxygen species. And so again, there's a slight increase in the NNT mutant as we would expect, but you add alcohol and that's dramatically elevated. And this we're providing an antioxidant. So that antioxidant treatment then reduces the overall levels of reactive oxygen. So we have this gene environment interaction for neuronal apoptosis and the overall level of reactive oxygen species.
Johan, can I ask a question before you go on?
Absolutely.
Would you go back one? So it's not significant between the control mutants and wild types in terms of apoptosis?
Here.
On the very left, yeah, right there.
You know, Raina collected these data, and her in on these are still fairly low. And I think this is bordering on significance, but it's underpowered. So yeah. Once she gets that number up, we'll see what happens. But it may well prove significant. But notably, what we find is that these apoptotic cells are not sort of randomly localized through the central nervous system. So what you see here is a schematic, a side view of a zebrafish. So the eye, this is the midbrain, this is the hindbrain. Down here are the pharyngeal arches that are making the face. So for what I'm telling you about today, you can just take a look at these little blue dots. This is where apoptotic cells are localized in the embryo. And here, if we come down to this a mutant exposed to 1% ethanol, we see a highly non-random distribution of apoptotic cells. And if anyone has any ideas of how to really quantify non-randomness other than that they look clumped together, appreciate anything like that. So both in the face and the brain, these are non-randomly localized. So that these different populations of neurons, something about them is making them more sensitive to this effect.
Johan, if I could, I had a thought that maybe they're clonally related.
Yeah, that's a good thought. Let me write that down. We haven't done anything that would look at that. I guess we could use like one of these Rainbow, it's called zebra bow and zebrafish for whatever reason, but yeah, to take a look at the clonal analysis. But that's a good idea. We should look into that. Thank you. All right. So this is sort of for the first part, sort of the goals that we want to accomplish with our work here moving forward. So looking at the overall levels and specifically also the location of stress and apoptosis across a bunch of different genotypes, both up here in the antioxidant ability as well as the mTOR pathway. We want to specifically look at oxidative stress on mTOR activity. So this little arrow here, and then the effects of antioxidants. We saw that we can reduce oxidative stress. Really, what does that happen due to the neural phenotypes that we see? The last thing that we want to do for this part of it, looking in this circle, it's easy to detect apoptosis. Sort of this is much more difficult. So we certainly have evidence that the dopaminergic system is more sensitive, but we want to globally identify sensitive populations. And so the small size of zebrafish makes it really useful for single cell RNA-seq. And so you can determine that you can analyze the differentiation of different cell types within the embryo at a single cell level. So we want to be able to do that to really comprehensively define neuronal sensitivity to ethanol.
Johan, let me ask you a question. You mentioned earlier the suggestion that a certain amount of oxidative stress is actually a signal for neuronal differentiation. So, typically in these experiments, we see that an increase in oxidative stress leads to apoptosis, and then we use N-acetylcysteine or some other antioxidant, and we can block that effect of alcohol, but we're tampering with a system that may be regulating subtleties of neuronal differentiation. And do you have a sense, when you look just at your antioxidant treatment group, whether you are not disrupting something that depends on oxidation as a signal, and that muting oxidation doesn't have an adverse effect on development itself?
Right. I mean, that's an excellent question. And so the direct answer of have we looked is no. But no, I mean, I think that it's a very excellent point. So, I mean, the model is basically that there a certain level is required. And so then in acetylcysteine or something like that, you might expect to have an effect on it. And so I think, you know, in the, it might be something that we could think about doing within the single cell RNA-seq data to really, again, sort of comprehensively profile the effect of that. Because, I mean, otherwise, we're just kind of grabbing at straws, picking particular cell populations, which might not be the most expeditious way to do so. But I think it's an excellent point. And if anyone has better ideas than the single cell RNA-seq to address that, I'd love to hear them.
So I'll just say that my question arises from a much older literature when people were looking at MAP and SAL, which are, you know, derivatives of growth factors that are important in development, but also block oxidative entry in the brain. And people worried that when they were doing that, that there would be some other effect, because they're really fragments of, you know, activity-dependent neurotrophic factor and so on. but what they were able to show is that the peptide itself, while blocking the effects of oxidative stress, did not interfere with development. And at least in both anatomical and behavioral studies in mice and rats, they were able to show that they performed as well, if not better. So, you know, I think as you write this grant, somebody is going to probably wonder how you know that your antioxidant isn't causing its own problems. And I think you can't know what you don't know, but if you look at an integrated neuronal network response, like a behavior, it puts you in better shape to say nothing bad happened with the antioxidant treatment alone.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's a good idea. I think the behavioral analysis is something that we're already set up to do in the lab. Yeah, then you could say that neurocircuitry at least is okay. Yeah, thank you.
Johan, I just have a quick methodological question. So when was the antioxidant applied? At what time relative to the alcohol?
In this, so this experiment has been done once, and it was administered at the same time. We haven't tested any other timing with it, but I guess the basis of your question, it would be good to take a look at different timing of the administration as well. Yeah. Any other thoughts before I move on?
I'd like to go back to your question about, rather than quantifying the randomness of the clumping,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, and I don't have, you know, I don't understand the zebrafish brain anatomy well enough, but are those clumps located in places that they're going to develop into particular regions of interest or particular cell types? Because you expressed an interest in identifying cell types. Can you tell by location?
Yeah, so based on location, this is the mid-hindbrain boundary. This is sort of mostly rhombomere 2, maybe spilling out a little bit into rhombomere 3, and this is rhombomere 4. Very distinct populations of motor neurons develop from those locations, but we haven't seen any striking difference in the number of motor neurons. So we think that it must be different neuronal populations that aren't, at least what I've found, aren't well characterized for R2 and R4. You know, the midbrain, more is known about that, and there are indeed dopaminergic neurons that are being born in this region. And so that might give us some inroad into that population. I have.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. Okay.
Yep, that's good. Thank you.
Yep. Yeah. All right. So then I'm just going to finish up with just a little bit of the data that we have, how we want to take a look at the further modulation of these phenotypes. And so one of the things that we've been interested in is, and obviously everybody, that the outcomes of an alcohol exposure are not uniform. And so we were thinking, similar to what Rajesh and Tina found in humans with zebrafish, because they're born externally, we can actually characterize phenotypes while they're alive. We can quantify those phenotypes and then based on that, try to find, modifiers, either genetic or chemical of effect instead of exposure, which basically the previous RNA data set that I was talking about is of exposure. It's just everyone was exposed. We want to know if we can determine sensitivity based on effect. And so this is a little complicated. This is data that we got yesterday. We're really excited about it. And so any thoughts on it are again, welcome. So basically we were interested in whether or not there were coordinate defects or covarying defects caused by alcohol. And so we used this neuronal marker and plus this transgenic, which labels neural crests. So we're looking at the brain and the face. And each little dot is the level of fluorescent from an individual embryo. And so orange is control, alcohol is blue. And unfortunately, we, because of the nature of the cross, we didn't get a lot of double transgenics out of this. So it's, again, underpowered. But we see basically a lot of variation in the x-axis here of fluorescence of ELAP, so for mature neurons. So there's quite a range. And there's a weak correlation with the face there. But if we take a look now at alcohol-exposed fish, we see in general, as we would expect from our previous data, that there is less. So we have a lot more embryos over here to the right of these alcohol-exposed fish, but we have alcohol-exposed fish that are kind of mingling here in the middle of these control fish. And so we need to increase our data set here, but the notion is what we want to do, and again, we're not sure the best way to do it, figure out maybe what we were thinking of is figure out what two standard deviations off of normal would be in our control group and then identify fish that were within that in our exposed group to then compare them to other fish. But so we see this intermingling. Some of these fish are exposed fish are intermingled well within control fish. And what we've been seeing already from our transcriptomic data is that there's transcriptomic intermingling of alcohol exposed fish as well. And so this is an RNA-seq data. So mutants here are those NNT mutants. This isn't the bit that's really of interest for what I'm talking to you about today. So this is a principal component analysis. Looking at the variation across the entire data set, most of that variation is explained by genotype. But then the next principal component is explained by exposure. And so genotype by exposure, they separate completely. But if you're wild type, we do not fully separate those. That we have alcohol exposed fish that are now intermingled amongst the control fish. And so we think what we want to do is combine these two. So now can we take the phenotypic outcome based on ELAV like 3, do the transcriptomics, and then see if in something like this principal component analysis that those fish that are intermingled amongst these non-exposed fish actually have a transcriptomic signature that is also more similar to the unexposed fish. And then this would provide us transcriptomic data that would distinguish an effective ethanol versus a fish that's not highly affected by ethanol. And so that's a big part of it. The last thing, we're still interested in forward genetics. I've talked to you a lot about this, but this is, another pretty recent fish that we got. So we're using a transposon. It's super cool because when you get a mutagenic insertion, the fish turns green. And so you already know who's carrying a mutation, so we can screen for these mutants very rapidly and test for ethanol sensitivity. And so, yeah, so then for this last little bit, we want to do the transcriptomics to identify modulators and continue our forward genetic screen. And that's all I have. So if you have any other questions or suggestions, I'd love to hear it.
Well, that's pretty impressive outside of my area. So I have some naive questions, all right? This link technique that you used, and you identified these chemicals that appear to have similar mechanisms or whatever. Has anyone looked at using that technique of other teratogens that may cause phenocopies of FAS-like behavior?
Not that I'm aware of, actually. So my grad student, Alfira, I think, was the first to use. People have used it in alcoholism studies a lot, but as far as teratogens go, I'm not familiar with anyone else having done that.
Yeah, I'd be interested in seeing what toluene looks like.
Toluene or hydantin or anything that gives you similar facial type of anomalies, whether or not they operate under the same chemicals that are being identified in the link. I mean, I don't know. It's a naive question because I don't understand it. But
right. No, that might. I think that's a. It's a good suggestion. Yeah, because then you can use the similarity and phenotypic outcome of the two chemicals to maybe narrow down what changes are most relevant that you want to search for. Because I know when Alfira used it, she got positive hits, and I have another grad student who's used it to modulate a genetic mutant phenotype. But you get positive hits, but they're, it's like maybe 1 in 5. But that might be a way to get a higher proportion of hits that are really relevant.
And you don't need to be nice. If it's a stupid question, just say it's a stupid question. But And then I was wondering if Mike Suddy had any ideas about analysis of randomization. I don't know if Mike's still here or not, but.
So I want to just offer a suggestion to those people who are preparing for the CFAS-5 reverse site visit, which is never say that that was a stupid question.
What, my own question?
No, never tell the questioner that was a stupid question.
Oh,
they're all excellent questions.
It's always a great question.
So I don't know if Mike's there or not, but facial analysis, they look at these non-random, that things cluster together. I know he did that with his facial analysis. So are there techniques, yep, Michael, to do those things?
Are you referring to the graph and this is unsupervised learning technique, clustering technique we were using? That can essentially be applied to, I guess, anything. So, yeah.
And then the only thing I wanted to mention is that Johan and Scott are both affiliated scientists on the CFAS-5 application. So, you know, we can continue to have interactions and with the both of them in CFAS, and good luck with the R01.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Stupid or not? All right, well, thank you, Johan. All right, publication committee, Sarah.
Coming. All right. So it's been a while since I've been able to report for the publication committee. So we actually have a fair amount to say. I'd like to thank, of course, my committee and especially Jill for helping me prepare for these meetings. So we've had, actually, I think that number 107 is wrong because there's a few other concept proposals that have come in. You'll see some redundancy because of the length of time that I'm covering. We've had concept proposals that have moved into actually accepted publications. So we had 3 concept proposals over the last few months. We had a number of post-acceptance forms. I'm missing my manuscript submission form, so I'm thinking we didn't have any, but I'm not 100% sure. So we had a number of post-acceptance forms across the consortium, which is terrific, but you'll see that a number of these have already moved into accepted papers. So, you can actually get and see. This was the paper from Claire and Julie on mental health, which is, if you haven't read it, you absolutely should. It's a great paper. We had papers from Joanne. We actually have 2 papers, I think, from Joanne's group. This was in Frontiers in Neuroscience. And then this one was in alcoholism, but we don't have the post-acceptance form, but I wanted to highlight it anyway, because it has recently been published. And then we had some papers from other investigators previously associated with CFAS. And that's that for my report. Thank you.
And I'll just ask anyone who has recently had a paper accepted, if you could let Jill know, because we're updating the statistics for our presentation next week at the reverse site visit. So anything accepted in 2022 is particularly germane to one of the slides that we're presenting. Leah, on data access, I don't know if I have Leah here. There she is.
I'm I'm here, but my internet keeps telling me it's unstable. I don't have much to update. Since my last update, we have had one approval of data that was from someone who originally requested the data from Korea, from South Korea, and now she's a postdoc at Yale and successfully has been awarded the data. And we had one person who was interested in obtaining the data. She's a PhD student, but since she first applied for the data, she is going to work with Julie Cable as a PhD student. So I think she'll get the data through Julie.
All right. Anyone have any other exciting news or data for their projects or anything?
I wanted to announce that I recently got funding to be able to offer a postdoc. So if anyone knows anyone they might want to send my way, I'd greatly appreciate that. It's a tricky thing to find folks for postdocs, I think, but please send them my way.
And hopefully everyone saw that a budget was signed and NIAAA got, I think, of about a 5% increase in their budget. I don't know if Joe or Elizabeth want to comment on that.
I'd say that again, the question.
A budget was passed, and I think that the NIAAA got about, what, a 5% increase in their budget. Not that that's a tremendous amount, but it was good news that a budget got passed and you won't be working under a continuing resolution.
Yeah, definitely. How this relate to CVAS?
No, it doesn't. Just general information for everybody.
Thank you.
Although I do have questions about CFAS and the transition between CFAS 4 and CFAS 5. So there are some projects in CFAS 4 that are not moving forward or have not been proposed for CFAS 5. And I was wondering if those projects are eligible for carryover, a no-cost extension.
The second for sure. Yeah, the second for sure, no-cost extension. But the carryover, we can talk about it because it really depends on what the carryover will be performing, will be used for. So, but on principle, we're here to help. I think the reason of pandemic always come up. So for that reason alone, I think most people will give you green light as much as they can.
Okay, that's good news. Any other questions, issues? Any comments from the SAB? I know you guys have been, I appreciate it. Tremendous amount of time and effort you have all put in.
The only thing I want to say is just the continued progress on four, you know, and even after, you know, its end date, we know that the productivity is still going to be showing up in publications and new grant applications. And I think that's speaks very highly for the whole lot of you.
I mean, we have people who were in CFAS 1 and 2 who are still utilizing the data and citing CFAS in their publications. So that's good to see that everybody is remaining involved in it. So any other SAB comments?
Not for me.
What comments? He said.
Well, I don't know, Jill, how many practice sessions have they attended in the last 3 weeks? Do you have any account?
27.
So that's 27 hours of time each of them has put into these practice sessions, and I hope people have appreciated them. I think they've gone well, and we have a couple more next week. So any comments from people at NIAAA, Elizabeth or Joe?
Nope.
Good luck.
Hmm. I use all the luck I can get these days, trust me. All right, well, we have another one. Well, I have a practice session coming up in 15 minutes, so I will get off so I can get another cup of coffee. And unless anyone has any other comments or concerns, we can officially end this meeting. And thank you once again, Johan. Oh, Scott, can you stay on for a minute?
Yes, I can.
Yeah, thanks. Goodbye, everyone.